Never the pit comes between vehicles. Gorilla cuts her clothes in plain dark dresses, all made after the same unvarying pattern. If Matthew knew there was such a thing as fashion and dress, it was as much as he did. But he was quite sure that Anne's sleeve did not look at all like the sleeves the other girls wore. He recalled the cluster of little girls he'd seen around her that evening, all gaying waists of red and blue and pink and white. And he wondered why Marilla always kept her so plainly and soberly down. Of course it must be all right. Marilla knew best, and Marilla was bringing her up. Probably some wise, inscrutable motive was to be served thereby. But surely it would do no harm to let the child have one pretty dress. Something like Diana Barry always wore. Matthew decided that he would take her one. That surely could not be objected to as an unwarranted putting in of his oar. Christmas was only a fortnight off, and I think dress would be the very thing for a present. Matthew would decide satisfaction, put away his pipe and went to bed, while Marilla opened all the doors and aired the house. The very next evening, Matthew betook himself to Carmody to buy the dress, determined to get the worst over and have done with it. It would be, he felt assured, no trifling ordeal. There were some things Matthew could buy and prove himself no mean bargainer, but he knew he would be at the mercy of shopkeepers when it came to buying a girl's dress. After much cogitation, Matthew resolved to go to Samuel Lawson's store instead of William Blair's. To be sure, the Cuthberts always had gone to William Blair's. It was almost as much a matter of conscience with them as to attend the Presbyterian church and vote conservative. But William Blair's two daughters frequently waited on customers there, and Matthew held them in absolute dread. He could contrive to deal with them when he knew exactly what he wanted and could point it out. But in such a matter as this, requiring explanation and consultation, Matthew felt that he must be sure of the man behind the counter. So he would go to Lawson's, where Samuel or his son would wait on him. Alas, Matthew did not know that Samuel, in the recent expansion of his business, had said lady clerk also. She was the niece of his wife, and a very dashing young person indeed, with a huge drooping pompadour, big rolling brown eyes, and the most extensive and bewildering smile. She was dressed with exceeding smartness and wore several bangle bracelets that glittered and rattled and tinkled with every movement of her hands. Matthew was covered with confusion at finding her there at all, and those bangles completely wrapped his lips at one fell swoop. "What can I do for you this evening, Mr. Cuthbert?" Mrs. Dillon Harris inquired, bristling and ingratiating and tapping the counter with both hands. Any, well now, say any garden rakes?" stammered Matthew. Miss Harris looked somewhat surprised, as well she might, to hear a man inquiring for garden rakes in the middle of December. "I believe we have one or two left over," she said. "But they're upstairs in the locker room. I'll go and see." During her absence, Matthew collected his scattered senses for another effort. Miss Harris returned with the rake and cheerfully inquired, "Anything else tonight, Mr. Cuthbert?" Matthew took his courage in both hands and replied, "Well now, since you suggest it, I might as well take, that is, look at, try some hayseed." Miss Harris had heard Matthew Cuthbert called odd. She now concluded that he was entirely crazy. "We only keep hayseed in the spring," she exclaimed loftily. "We've not on hand just now." "Oh, certainly, just as you say," stammered unhappy Matthew, seizing the rake and making for the door. At the threshold, he recollected that he had not paid for it, and he turned miserably back. While Miss Harris was counting out his change, he rallied his powers for a final desperate attempt. "Well, now, if it isn't too much trouble, I might as well, that is, I'd like to look at some sugar." "Why, you're brown," queried Miss Harris patiently. "Oh, well now, brown, Well, I bet over there, said Miss Harris, shaking her bangles at it. It's the only kind we have. I'll take 20 pounds of it, said Matthew, with beads of perspiration standing on his forehead. Matthew was driven halfway home before he was his own man again. It had been a gruesome experience, but it served him right, he thought, for committing a heresy going to a strange shore. When he reached home, he hid the rake in the schoolhouse, but the sugar he carried in to Marilla. Brown sugar, exclaimed Marilla. Ever since I studied it so much. You know I never use it except for the hired man's porridge or black fruit cake. Sherry's gone, and I've made my cake long ago. It's not good sugar either. Close and dark. William Blair doesn't usually keep sugar like that. I thought it might come in handy sometime, said Matthew, making good his escape. So Matthew came to think the matter over, and he decided that a woman was required to cope with the situation. Marilla was out of the question. Matthew put food to his throat, cold water on his project at once. Remained only Mrs. Lynde, for of no other woman in Avonlea would Matthew dare to ask advice. To Mrs. Lynde he went accordingly, and that good lady promptly took the matter out of the harassed man's hands. You got a dress for you to give Anne? To be sure I will. I'm going to Carmody tomorrow and I'll attend to it. Have you something particular in mind? No? Well, I'll just go by my own judgment then. I believe a nice rich brown would just suit Anne, and William Blair has the new Gloria in that's real pretty. Perhaps you'd like me to make it up for her too, seeing that if Marilla was to make it, Anne would probably get wind of it before the time and spoil the surprise. Well, I'll do it. No, we didn't annoy the trouble. I like sewing. I'll make it to fit my niece, Jenny Dilla. For she and Anne are as like as two peas as far as figure goes. Well, now I'm much obliged, said Matthew. And I don't know. But I think they make the pleats different nowadays to what they used to be. If it wouldn't be asking too much, I'd like them made in the new way. Tops? Of course. You needn't worry a speck more about it, Matthew. I'll make it up in the very latest fashion, said Mrs. Lynde. To herself, Matthew.com. It'll be a real satisfaction to see that fourth child wearing something decent for once. The waiting room advance is very positively ridiculous, that's what. An odd ache to tell her so plainly a dozen times. I've held my tongue, though, for I've been seeing her really a dozen monkey times, and she thinks she knows more about bringing children up than I do, for all she's an old maid. But that's always the way. Folks that have brought up children know there's no hard and fast method in the world that'll suit every child. But then there's never had, it's all plain and easy as rule of three. Just set your three terms down so gradually, and the sum will work out correct. But flesh and blood don't come under the head of arithmetic, and that's where Marilla Cuthbert makes her mistake. I suppose she's trying to cultivate a spirit of humility in Anne by dressing her as she does, but it's more likely to cultivate envy and discontent. I'm sure this child must feel the difference between her clothes and the other girls. To think of Matthew taking notice of it. That man is waking up after being asleep for over 60 years. Marilla knew all the following fortnight that Matthew had something on his mind, but what it was she could not guess until Christmas Eve, when Mrs. Lynde brought up the new dress. Marilla behaved pretty well on the whole, although it is very likely she distrusted Mrs. Lynde's diplomatic explanation that she'd made the dress because Matthew was afraid Anne would find out about it too soon if Marilla made it. So this is what Matthew's been looking so mysterious over and grinning about to himself for 2 weeks, is it? She said a little stiffly, but tolerantly. I knew he was up to some foolishness. Well, I must say, I don't think Anne needed any more dresses. I made her three good, warm, serviceable ones this fall, and anything more is sheer extravagance. But Matthew's material in those sleeves alone can make a waste, I declare, Darius. You'll just pamper Anne's vanity, Matthew, and she's as vain as a peacock now. Well, I hope she'll be satisfied at last, for I know she's been hankering after those silly sleeves ever since they came in, although she never said a word after the first. Perhaps she's been getting bigger and more ridiculous right along. They're as big as balloons now. Next year, anybody who wears them will have to go through a door sideways. Christmas morning broke on a beautiful white world. It had been a very mild December, and people had looked forward to a green Christmas. Just an out from the frosted gable window with delighted eyes. The forest and the haunted wood were all feathery and wonderful. The roots of the moss cherry trees were outlined in pearl. The plowed fields were stretches of snowy dimples. And there was a crisp tang in the air that was glorious. Anne ran downstairs singing until her voice re-echoed through Green Gables. Merry Christmas, Marilla. Merry Christmas, Nancy. Isn't it a lovely Christmas? I'm so glad it's white. Any other kind of Christmas doesn't seem real, does it? I don't like green Christmases. They're not green. They're just nasty faded browns and grays. What makes people call them green? Why, on earth do? Matthew sheepishly unfolded the dress from its paper swathings and held it out with a deprecatory glance at Marilla, who feigned to be content with the doll and teapot. Nevertheless, watched the scene out of the corner of her eye with a rather interested air. And took the dress and looked at it in reverent silence. Oh, how pretty it was. A lovely, soft brown glory with all the gloss of silk. A skirt with dainty frills and shirrings. A waist elaborately pin-tucked in the most fashionable way, with a little ruffle of filmy lace at the neck. But the sleeves, they were the crowning glory. Long elbow cuffs, and above them two beautiful puffs divided by rows of shirring and bows of brown silk ribbon. That's a Christmas present for you, Anne, said Matthew shyly. Why, Anne, don't you like it? Well, for Anne's eyes had suddenly filled with tears. Like it? Oh, nasty! Anne laid the dress over the chair and clasped her hands. Matthew, it's perfectly perfect. Oh, I can never thank you enough. Look at those sleeves. Oh, it seems to me this must be a happy dream. Well, let us have breakfast, interrupted Marilla. I must say, Anne, I don't think you needed the dress. But since Matthew's got it for you, see that you take good care of it. There's a hair ribbon Mrs. Lynch left for you. It's brown to match the dress. Come now, sit in. I don't see how I'm going to eat breakfast, said Anne rapturously. Breakfast seems exciting moment. The rabbit keeps my eyes on that grass. I'm so glad that puff sleeves are so fashionable. It did seem to me that I'd never get over it if they went out before I had a dress with them. I've never felt quite satisfied, you see. It was lovely of Mrs. Lynde to give me the ribbon, too. I feel that I ought to be a very good girl indeed. It's at times like this, I'm sorry I'm not a model little girl. And I always resolve that I will be in future. But somehow it's hard to carry out your resolutions when irresistible temptations come. Still, I really will make an extra effort after this. When the commonplace breakfast was over, Diana appeared, crossing the white log bridge in the hollow, a gay little figure in her crimson ulster. Then flew down the slope to meet her. Merry Christmas, Diana, and all of your wonderful Christmas. Matthew is giving me the loveliest dress. That sleeve. I couldn't even imagine any nicer. Couldn't think any more for you, said Diana breathlessly. Here, the socks. I just have been sent a pair of big socks. And ever so many things in it. This is for you. I brought it over last night, but didn't come until after dark. And it was so very comfortable coming through the haunted wood in the dark now. Anne opened the box and peeked in. First, card with "For the Anne Girl and Merry Christmas" written on it. And then a pair of the daintiest little kid slippers with beaded toes and satin bows and glistening buckles. "Oh," said Anne. "Diana, this is too much. I must be dreaming. I call it providential," said Diana. "You won't have to borrow Ruby's slippers now, and that's a blessing. For the two sizes too big for you. It would be awful to hear a fairy shuffling. Josie Pye would be delighted. Mind you, Walter, I went home with Gertie Pye from the practice night before last. Did you ever hear anything equal to that?" All the Avenue scholars were in a fever of excitement that day. So the hall had to be decorated and a last grand rehearsal held. The concert came off in the evening and was a keynote success. The little hall was crowded. All the performers did excellently well. But Anne was the bright particular star of the occasion, as even envy in the shape of Josie Pye to very well, said Diane practically. I guess we must have made as much as $10. Mind you, Mr. Allen is to have sent an account of it to the Charlottetown papers. Oh, Diane, will we really see our names in print? It makes me feel to think of it. Your soul is perfectly elegant, Diana. I felt prouder than you did when it was on the court. I just said to myself, it is my dear bosom friend who is so honored. Well, your reputation has just brought down the house, man. That bad one was simply splendid. Oh, I was so nervous, Diana. When Mr. Allen called up my name, I really cannot tell how I've ever gone up on that platform. I felt as if a million eyes were looking at me, through me. And for one dreadful moment, I was sure I couldn't begin at all. Then I thought of my lovely puffed sleeves and took courage. I knew that I must live up to those sleeves, Diana. So I started in, and my voice seemed to be coming from ever so far away. It just felt like a parrot. It's providential that I practice those recitations so often in the garret, or I'd never have been able to get through. Did I grow them all right? Yes, indeed. You grow them lovely, assured Diana. I saw old Mrs. Sloan wiping away tears when I sat down. It was splendid to think I'd touched somebody's heart. It's so nice to take part in the concert, isn't it? Oh, it's been a very memorable occasion indeed. Wasn't the boys' dialogue fine, said Diana? Your life is just splendid. And I do think it's awful mean the way you treat Bill. Wait till I tell you. When you ran off the platform after this very dialogue, one of your roses fell out of your hair. I saw Gil pick it up and put it in his breast pocket. Damn! It's so romantic that I'm sure you ought to be pleased with that. It's nothing to me what that person does, said Anne loftily. I simply never waste a thought on him, Diana. That night, Marilla and Matthew, who'd been out to a concert for the first time in 20 years, sat for a while by the kitchen fire after Anne had gone to bed. Well, now, I guess our Anne did as well as any of them, said Matthew proudly. Yes, she did, admitted Marilla. She's a bright child, Matthew. And she looks real nice, too. She's been kind of opposed to this concert scheme, but I suppose there's no real harm in it. now I was tearing up her and I did tell her so. For she went upstairs, said Matthew. We must see what we can do for her some of these days, Marilla. I think she'll need something more than Avonlea school by and by. It's soon enough to think of that, said Marilla. 'Tis only 13 in March. Though tonight it struck me that she was growing quite a big girl. Mrs. Lynde made that dress a mite too long, and it makes Anne look so tall. She's quick to learn, and I guess the best thing we can do for her will be to send her to Queen's after herself. But nothing need be said about that for a year or two yet. Well, now, it'll do no harm to be thinking it over off and on, said Matthew. Things like that are all the better for lots of thinking over. End of chapter 25. According